This is Stars for the Rest of Us, episode 90. Welcome to Stars for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome to launch software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
Tell you what, July has been a tough month. Today is my fifth day of work, and in July, it's the 24th of the month.
Slacker.
You know, it's the summer, right? So my kid that is going to be in first grade is off for the summer, and my wife is off for the summer as well. So we've been doing a bunch of traveling, went to Denver, went to Reno and spoke at ISVCon a couple weeks ago.
And
then, you know, it was fun. It was a small conference, and it was a different crowd than we typically see. I don't think anyone from any of the other conferences I go to were there. So it was more of the desktop software developers, shareware guys, because it's based on the ASP, which was the Association of Software Professionals. Mm-hmm. And there used to be a conference called, SIC, I think,
yeah.
Software Industry Conference that was held in Texas and a couple other places. And that conference kind of died as I don't know why, but it seemed like the shareware movement kind of slowed down, for obvious reasons. Sue, and I forget how you pronounce her last name, but it's like Sue Pachoda, I think. She resurrected ISVCon or SIC and renamed it ISVCon. And this was the first year back. So it was, as a result, it was pretty small because they didn't have the momentum of, having multiple years of folks going. But I did get to hang out with some good folks. Patrick Foley was there, and he actually spoke on Sunday. Ted Pitts from MoreAware was there. Ruben was there from BidSketch. And then I met, Dave Collins' partner with Software Promotions. It was good. It was better for the people. From my perspective, it was a better conference because of the people who were there rather than the talks or the topics that were covered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for most conferences, that's pretty typical. It's better to talk to the people as opposed to, the conference is just an excuse, I'll say.
Right, although they did have a nice sports bar that was half off all drinks till like 7 p.m. I wound up in like an 8 or 9 hour conversation with a couple of the guys just talking about SaaS apps and marketing and different approaches and trading SEO tips and advertising tips and funnel optimization and just throwing out ideas and problems. So that was fun. I mean, it felt like a 9 or 10 hour mastermind meeting with some pretty sharp people. And that's got to be the highlight of it for me.
Very cool.
How about yourself? Where are you at this time of month?
Oh, well, I'm in Delaware right now. Having never been here before, I didn't necessarily have high expectations, but those expectations were absolutely shattered. There seems to be absolutely nothing here.
Yeah.
The nearest airport to me is Baltimore, which is a 2.5 hour drive away. So I flew into Baltimore and then drove down here. And there was just nothing between the airport and here. I mean, there wasn't even a highway. It was all back roads. I really felt like I was in rural upstate New York and nothing but cornfields and cows. I mean, it's just nothing.
Right.
It's not a bad area. It's just there's nothing here. That's all.
Right, right. The theme for my month of July is goals and focus. I've been kind of honing in on a couple of goals I have with Hittail, as well as some goals I have in terms of getting back blogging again. I've realized, man, it's hard to stay focused, like when you're doing a lot of things. All the stuff we have on our plates and most entrepreneurs tend to put on our plates, it's just a challenge to keep moving forward in all of those things. And so you tend to not move forward in any of them. So I've really been making an effort to basically, like, if I get emails about things that I'm not focusing on right now, I will literally just send them out with boomerang and tell them, like, come back in 2 weeks. Obviously, if something's an emergency, I can't do that. But for the most part, I've been just putting off anything that has nothing to do with my key goal for the month. And the goal this month is growing Hittail. July is going to be the best month ever for Hittail. And in fact, it's probably going to be the largest single month of growth ever, even though I wasn't working. And of course, the reason is that all the seeds for this were sown, a couple of months ago. It's like delayed. You do a bunch of marketing and then people come the next month or 2 months later. So, and then there's 30-day trials that put them even further back. So if I don't continue the marketing, and pick it up pretty hard now that I'm back from vacation, it'll obviously slow down probably in August or September. But it is something that I'm keeping in mind. It's about picking a single goal and trying to get to that goal and monitoring that goal every day I wake up. And the first thing I do is I look at my dashboard. I have a dashboard of a bunch of numbers, lifetime value, churn rate, trial to paid conversions. It's just a rolling 30-day average. And so I now have a very tight pulse on the business. And as a result, it keeps my mind focused on it, both good and bad. The good part is I'm focused on it, so it's growing. The bad part is I am thinking about it all the time, but I'm really mentally kind of thinking about Hittail, what to do with it, how to grow it, tactics I'm going to use, and all that stuff, even when maybe I should be slowing down and not working.
Cool. What do you use for your dashboard? I think I asked you this before. You use a custom dashboard, don't you?
Yeah, because I do. It's just a single ASP page. I wouldn't use ASP normally, but that's what the app's written in. And it's just a bunch of hacked queries, very simple. It's just black text on a white background, you know, the login screen in front of it. Yeah, I've honed these queries, and every probably week or two, I realize there's numbers that I want that aren't there, and I'll start calculating them manually. And if I calculate it manually a few times, suddenly I realize I really should just add it to the dashboard. Even if the query is pretty complicated, since I'm the only one running it and I don't run it that often, even if it's slow, it's still worth having. So yeah, I have my real-time LTV, so I can see how it changes based on how many articles are ordered, how many people were billed last night, how many people canceled in the last, you know, 24 hours impacts both my lifetime value, my churn rate, my trial-to-paid conversions, all that stuff. So it's a very interesting, it's an interesting approach to it. I don't think it's something I want to do long-term, but especially in these early days of the business when things are volatile and they're still moving around pretty dramatically, I feel like it's good to have. I think over time, what I'd like to do is get some graphs so I can actually watch more of a moving average of it, because that's really the more important part of it. And also, I think as a business matures, this stuff's going to kind of settle down as more processes are being developed. You know, when the marketing's more stable, the cost per acquisition, the LTV, those things all become much more stable as I'm not doing these big kind of experiments, which is essentially what I'm running. I've purchased more clicks in the past 30 days for Hittail than I have for all of my other apps combined in the last 12 months. I'm just experimenting like crazy and just throwing money at it. My LTV hit the point where I can totally scale this thing. I just need to find a couple scalable marketing approaches.
Very cool. Yeah, for your dashboard, the reason I was wondering about whether you build it yourself or not was because there's a couple of different companies out there that offer some dashboarding technologies, I'll say. One of them is Good Data, which I looked at it a couple of years ago, but at the time, their entry-level pricing was something like $2,000 or $3,000 a month, and I'm just like, no.
So it's an enterprise dashboard then. It's BI, as they call it, right? Business intelligence.
Yeah, and the other one I saw, which I think it just came out of beta back in December or so, it's called Dig My Data, which Peldy actually is an advisor of them. So they have all these integration points for a lot of different data sources like Google Analytics and PayPal and Gmail and MailChimp, et cetera.
Totally. Yeah. So I was actually a beta tester of Dig My Data, and I know Adam. He's a nice guy. He's one of the founders. We hooked up at Business Software. Yes, I actually like it a lot. I haven't been using it because of a certain way they need to track sales, and it was just a little more of a pain in the neck than I wanted to do for my particular setup. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of people, at least a dozen folks who use it, who really like it. Mm-hmm. And Peldy is not a super data guy, and he's totally into it. So I buy it. Mm-hmm. You know, the other one, Kissmetrics, I actually do have a Kissmetrics account. We got a free one for going to MicroConf.
Yep.
And so I do have that all set up on Hittail, and I use it for some things, but I don't use it for everything. I tend to use Google Analytics and my custom dashboard.
Right. Oh, you know what? I was doing some math the other day, and this is episode 90, and I was thinking, episode 100 is coming up in the not-too-distant future. And I said, well, you know, we should probably do something, you know, kind of special for the 100th episode. And after doing the math on it, I realized that episode 100 is scheduled to go live on October 10th. And guess what else is scheduled to go live that week?
I don't new season of The Walking Dead?
No, close. Very close.
Close? All right.
Audit Shark.
Yes. Well, so Audit Shark's supposed to go to beta September 10th, right?
Right.
And then you're figuring you'll go live 1 month later?
Right, roughly.
Awesome. You heard it here first.
That's the current plan. We'll see how that works out.
That will be such a milestone for us. Now, the problem is we'll record that episode a week earlier.
Right.
So you won't actually be launched, but you know what? So that'll be cool. So episode 100, we do need to think of something cool to do for that, though.
Mm-hmm. So, hey, today's episode, we're going to go over a bunch of podcast questions because people have been sending us a bunch of emails and asking a bunch of different things. So why don't we just dig right into those? The first question is from Chico, and he says, my name's Chico, and I listen to your podcast all the way from Zimbabwe. I think it's great, and it has helped me in aspects of managing myself and following my passion. In the midst of building one business, I realized I wasn't so much in love with it because of other pressures that had built up. In short, I discovered there's a lot more that goes into design, like the customer support, building, etc., that my initial idea got less interesting. I love the web and developing a lot, but I wanted to know what you guys think about a 180-degree pivot. I've discovered I'm a startup person where I create a product that I run as opposed to creating lots of products that ship out constantly. The pressure is enormous, and it gets into a routine that can be monotonous. Given that I want to run a startup I'm developing right now, how can I best bring down the curtain on my previous business? And more importantly, how can I battle with the fear that I might be leaving an opportunity and charging into uncertainty? Thanks a lot for your feedback. Keep up the good work. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I feel like there's some details left out of the question, like whether or not he has existing customers on the other one or whether it's just a work in progress, because obviously your approach tends to differ based on those factors. I think if you don't have any customers and you've totally lost passion for your old idea and you don't want to do it anymore, aside from just having to deal with the fact that, you know, you wasted time, essentially, I think you just shut it down and you stop working on it. I think if you have existing customers, you can, well, if the thing's just running by itself, if it's a SaaS app, I don't know that you necessarily need to shut it down unless it's a lot of support. If it is a lot of support, you can try to sell it. You can try to offer it to the customer so they can install it on their own servers. I mean, I think there are some fairly simple ways to get out of that. If it's not a SaaS app, if it's downloadable software and people already have it downloaded, I mean, I think you just update the site and say, look, you know, we've stopped development on it. We will support bugs and stuff, but no new features will be developed, and stop selling it. So I don't think that's too hard. I think the bigger question is, second part, which is how can I battle with the fear I might be leaving an opportunity and charting into uncertainty? And I think the best way to essentially appease that fear or get rid of that is not to charge into uncertainty, but it's to start talking to customers and start building a mailing list and start doing the pre-coding stuff that we talked about. You know, it's both customer development and talking to customers, but it's also trying to analyze the market using keyword tools, building a landing page, driving traffic, seeing if anyone wants to get on a mailing list to hear about it. It's those things that you should spend time doing before you write a line of code to validate the idea. And the more you're able to validate, you're never going to get it to 100%, but you can maybe get it to 50 or 60 or 70%. The more emails you gather, the more potential customers you talk to. And to me, that is how you're going to fight that uncertainty and give yourself the both the confidence as well as kind of the staying power with this idea that if you do in fact think it's going to work, you're going to be more likely to stick around and keep working on it.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you said. The other thing that comes to mind is whether or not the business he's currently working on is more of a full-time income for him. Because I think that changes things a lot if it is your current full-time income versus if it's your full-time income, you can't just take the thing and shut it down. You can't just take it and sell it off because there are obvious risks associated with that. But if it's just something you're doing on the side, and as you said, if you don't have a lot of customers, then it doesn't necessarily matter as much. I think the big question is kind of where existing revenue comes from. Is that from a full-time job, or is it from this business? And I think that right there would probably make, in my mind, a lot of the decisions for me.
Right. And if, in fact, you are making a full-time living off of it, then that means it's probably a pretty successful app. And I think there are opportunities to sell it, whether it's through something like Flippa or whether it's through your blog or becoming, I mean, there are people in the Micropreneur Academy who would be more than happy to look at an app that provides a full-time income. So I think that's definitely, and that could potentially be a way, if it is successful, to get some revenue out of it or some kind of upfront money that you can then use to fund yourself as you develop the next one.
Mm. And I think it's probably important to sell it upfront as opposed to kind of stringing things along, where the revenue kind of will probably tank, to be perfectly honest. If you're not paying attention to it at all and you just neglect it, my inclination is to believe that the revenue is eventually going to tank. It's just going to continue going down. And then when you do decide to sell it, it's just going to be worth that much less. You're better off just selling it up front and being done with it.
Exactly. If you know you're done with it, I would agree with that.
So, Chico, hopefully that helps answer your question. Our next question is from Till, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. Thanks a lot for the podcast. It's been an invaluable source of actionable advice. And on top of that, I really like the way you guys present it in that down-to-earth manner. Please keep up the great work. My question is, I'm working on a SaaS product, and I have the opportunity to get the generic product domain name with a .NET or .org top-level domain, like crmsoftware.net, for a fake example. I'm considering using this generic domain as my sales website for SEO reasons and hosting the app in another domain representing a specific product name like highrise.com to give another example. Another option would be to use the generic domain plus the top-level domain as a specific product name, for example, crmsoftware.net. But from an aesthetic perspective, I'd prefer a more custom product name. Please note that the users will likely access the app via their own subdomains. I'd appreciate hearing your thoughts on this. Thanks for your help, Till."
Obviously, Google give preference, or it gives a nice boost to generic top-level domain names. So if you get crmsoftware.net, you're going to naturally rank higher for CRM software for that phrase in Google. What I've been noticing and kind of been hearing rumblings of is that that boost may not be as much as it used to be. It's still really nice. It's still a really good signal that they use, but I don't know if in the future, moving forward, you know, how much that's going to continue to be there. I think it'll always be there. It just matters how much they dial it up and dial it down, right? So I guess the next thing I'll say is I don't feel super comfortable about separating the sales website from the application website. And I think, one, it's confusing to have two different top-level domain names between those two. And two, if you need any integration between the two of them, like when you have a sign-up form that does something and maybe it needs shared JavaScript from one to the other, or maybe it needs to share cookies between the two, it's not going to work, because browser security settings are a nightmare when it comes to using any client-side stuff across top-level domains. I've run into this a number of times. I've actually run into this with subdomains of the same top-level domain and had to do pretty hacky workarounds and like do double redirects and all types of fancy stuff that was really hacky in order to make sure that the like cookies held up between the sales website and the SaaS app. So if at all possible, I would lean towards keeping everything on the same TLD at a minimum, right? Even if you do subdomains, that's fine. But I would lean towards that unless there's a compelling reason not to. So with that said, you really have a choice, right? You can name your product fancy CRM, but you're going to get crmsoftware.net. I think your inclination is that shouldn't you have fancy crm.com? Right? You know, shouldn't you have the .com for your product name? And I think it depends on how much you plan on relying on SEO. If SEO is going to be a major player in your business and in your marketing approach, then I think buying crmsoftware.net, I know it's a fake example, but you know, I'm going to keep it the example. But I think that buying crmsoftware.net is a good approach. But if you're going to be marketing this thing, doing a lot of social media and press and stuff that means that SEO is actually only going to be a smaller percentage, 10 or 20% of your overall picture, then you may want to think about using your productname.com as the main website. I would buy both domains, definitely, but it's, you know, it all comes down to how you set it up. I think if you do decide that SEO is going to be a big part of your marketing approach and you go with crmsoftware.net, I definitely would buy fancycrm.com and just have a simple, you know, a 301 redirect to crmsoftware.net so that people can, you know, if they type in your productname.com, that they always get there. It's not going to give you any SEO benefit, but it will just help folks who are looking for your product. With the generic TLD, the crmsoftware.net, you're still going to rank for your product name. I mean, that's going to be a foregone conclusion, because you're going to get a handful of links for your product name, and then bam, you're going to rise right to the top. So that's not an issue I'd be concerned about at all.
I think that the SEO boost from having that top-level domain name matching whatever the search term is great to have. But like you said, I mean, Google could turn around at any moment and just completely drop it from their algorithm. I mean, the fact is that in any given language, there are only so many words that can be used to describe different things. And using that as a, I'll call it a biased factor in the algorithm, eventually it kind of falls over, because just because you were there first doesn't mean that you're doing the best at it. And Google has come right out and said, you know, we're weighting a lot of updated content much higher than people whose web pages haven't changed in 10 months or 20 months or whatever. So if you start following that line of thinking, you might also say, well, why should a domain that's been around for 10 years have more weight than one that has been around for 5 years or 3 years, you know, because you start looking back at those things, and just because somebody was there first for CRM software and they get crmsoftware.com, they've had the domain name for 10 or 15 years, does that mean that it is updated? Does that mean that they know things better than somebody else who's only been around for 2 or 3 years? And I think there's other things that weigh into that a lot more.
Well, right now, Google says yes.
I understand that they say that yes now.
Yep.
But in the future, that's just one thing that you're basing this decision off of. That's kind of my point.
Right. I think the worst case, though, as I'm thinking about it, is if he gets the generic and optimizes for it and starts ranking for it, and then Google turns that down, mm-hmm. you know, turns down that signal, he could always change later. And as long as he gets his, you know, fancycrm.com, you know, his productname.com URL, he could always just move the website there, 301 everything. If SEO becomes not as large of a part of his marketing, or he loses the rankings because of, you know, the TLD stops being worth it, then that's actually not the end of the world to do that.
Right.
So
I'm kind of torn on it myself. I mean, I think that it's really nice to have that for the SEO benefit, but on the other side, customers don't necessarily relate well to a product name that is generic like that. And I wonder if it might be either interesting or a good idea to go in a slightly different direction where you get both domain names. And then for the domain name that is the generic one, you basically make it into a review site. And then you obviously would link heavily to your own domain. You would review your own software, and maybe you review it favorably or not favorably or whatever. But that's another option where you could basically give yourself some SEO benefit by linking directly from that domain. And, you know, you could also use it as an educational site. I mean, you could just talk about, in general, these are the things you should be looking for if you want this particular type of software.
Yeah, I think building a satellite website, like you said, or a microsite, as some people call them, I think that could be done. I don't know if I'd make it a review site. A review site would be decent, I guess. I would almost have someone else write it, though. That feels a little, you know, a little weird if you're writing content about your own, without disclosing it, if you're writing content about your own app.
Right.
I'd almost want to hire a third party to do it, or just not make it a review site and make it about, you know, something else, just an educational site where you happen to have a banner. That's obviously going to cut down. I mean, that, you know, if you rank number one for that term for CRM software, you're only going to get a couple percentage click through from there. So you really are killing off most of the traffic. It's not going to make it to your sales website. So while it is an approach you can do, I don't know that it's as good. I agree. I'm torn as well. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here. I just think it's what you feel comfortable with and kind of how you're going to be marketing the product. If it's going to be, you know, 90% SEO, then it's an obvious response here. But if it's going to be mostly a branded product, then I think you go the other route.
Well, I think that about wraps it up. Until, hopefully that answered your question, and thanks for getting in touch. Hopefully things will work out for you and you come to a good decision on that. Our next question is from Sean, and he said, Rob, you mentioned using AppSumo to get a boost of capital in the early stages of Hittail, and I'm stoked because I love the guys over there and I'm happy that it delivered for you. I'm wondering what other avenues or opportunities you and Mike can suggest to get jumps in revenue or financing in the early stages of a product's life. I'm a big fan of maintaining control of the product as long as possible and not going the investor route.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on this. I guess first I'll clarify, I didn't do the AppSumo deal for a boost of capital as much as I did because I wanted to get the word out. I don't actually need the capital right now as much as just, you know, spreading the word in that respect. But this is a good question. I like this line of thinking. It's basically you've started off, you've launched your product to some success, but you need some capital for some reason. And I would be hesitant to say that you need a bunch of capital to buy ads and do paid acquisition, because if you're still this early in your startup, then odds are pretty good that you are not going to have the lifetime value and the cost per acquisition where you need it to actually make that a viable thing. So hopefully you're not thinking that you're going to raise the cash just to spend it on ads, but to use it in some other strategic way. But a couple ideas do come to mind. AppSumo is definitely one, any deal of the day site. I mean, there's like softwaredealoftheday.com, or it might be softwaredod.com. There is bitsdujour.com. There's several others, depending on your niche. There's a bunch of ones for the Mac too. So any of those can be a quick influx of cash. Another way that I've seen used is to do annual plans and to either offer them on the site directly, or if you're dealing, if you're doing any type of medium touch or high touch sales, that you talk to your customers and say, hey, you know, if you pay in advance for 12 months, we can cut you a pretty big discount. And you may have to offer a 2-3-4 month discount, depending on how far along your product is and how much people trust it and how much value they've already gotten out of it. But, you know, if you're charging $100 a month and you can suddenly get an influx of 8 or 9 months of capital, you have to support that customer for the next year. But that, you know, $800 or $900 can be a nice big influx. And if you can do that with a handful of customers in any given month, it starts to add up pretty quickly. I've also seen some apps do it directly on their site where when you go to sign up, it gives you that option and people can just pay in advance. Again, you do have to offer a discount, but it can still be a way to kind of eke some revenue out early. The other way that that I would recommend, and I've done this in the past, is to actually do offer customizations. So it's almost like you're consulting on your own product, but you can almost just consult in the space as well. So to give you examples of this, like with .NET Invoice early on, I would offer customizations for $125 or $150 an hour. So I didn't want to do a lot of them, right? But people didn't want to pay me to do a lot of them because it wasn't cheap. But if someone came along with 5 or 10 hours, suddenly you're doing a little bit of consulting work. It is kind of a pain, but you can make a little chunk of change that way. The other interesting thing is I'm getting emails constantly with Hittail. People want us to offer SEO advice, do link building, create content, you know, kind of do SEO services like a consultant would do. So while it's not a straight customization of my product, it is just affiliated or related consulting gigs. It's something that someone would be interested in if they're using your product. So I think those are probably three avenues that I would at least entertain. They all have drawbacks. I think they're pretty obvious what the drawbacks are. But if you're really trying to put together, you know, a little bucket of cash up front, I think those are definitely viable.
Yeah, the ones that came to mind for me were, you know, as you mentioned, the yearly plan. And then the other one was doing product integrations with other products. So if you have something that can integrate into pretty much any major vendor who has a pretty large audience and you can offer any sort of an integration between your product and theirs, a lot of times they're very happy to publicize that there is that integration to their existing customer base. And you may very well get a lot of signups as a result of that. It really depends a lot on what the other products are. Just to kind of throw out some examples, I know that you can do integrations with like MailChimp and Google Analytics is one, but obviously they're, you know, people aren't paying for that. But if there are products that people are already paying for, you know, as a subscription, then those are the types of people who are already willing to pay for a subscription, and they may very well be willing to pay an additional fee for a subscription to your product. So those are the things that I would probably look at as a good way to boost revenue. And the nice thing about that is that it's continuing. It's not just a one shot. I mean, obviously you'll get one shot in SEO benefits and, you know, the influx of traffic when, you know, whoever that integration partner is publicizes it. But on an ongoing basis, you'll get additional revenue based on the fact that those people are using their product and say, oh, well, I just found this product. Maybe it's Basecamp, and they're using Basecamp, and they say, oh, well, there's this integration with this other product over here. Maybe I'll go check that out. So thanks for the question, Sean. The next one we're going to go to is from, and I know I'm going to butcher this name, Laradius Thomas. And he says, hello, I'm not a tech individual, but I have an idea for an application that will assist entrepreneurs, but I don't have any experience with code or writing software. Where do you recommend I start? I would say start at episode one and start with...
Yeah, exactly. This is a big question.
It's a huge topic. It's an involved topic. And there are so many different things that you need to understand that just having an idea for something is not necessarily good enough. I mean, you basically have to prove that there is enough demand for whatever it is that your idea is that people are willing to pay for it. And until then, you're not going to have anyone who's going to be a developer who's going to sign on as a partner. You know, I think we've mentioned numerous times that you have to have at least two out of the three things to build a business. You either have to have the time, money, or skill set. Two out of those three things. And as long as you have two, then you're fine. And it sounds like, I mean, the email isn't clear. You don't say that you have money and you don't say that you have time to do it. But if you have time, then you can learn to write software. If you have money, you can pay somebody to write it. And you have if you have the skill set to either do the marketing or do the development, then that's at least half of the equation. But if you don't have those things, then you're kind of at a standstill. There's not much you're going to be able to do.
So I think the first thing to think about is how to prove out this idea, how to get as far as possible without having any code. And he doesn't give us much of an idea of what the app is. It's an application that will assist entrepreneurs. But is there any way to do this without code? Is there any way to do it via email, with Excel spreadsheets, with a VA, with your manual time, just doing stuff on the back end? Does it truly have to be software, or can you hack it and basically do human automation and get your thing launched? And even if you don't have a website at all, if this helps entrepreneurs, then find entrepreneurs and start helping them with this. You know, and if you need to throw up a WordPress website and use a theme and edit some text, then learn how to do that and get people to it and then start helping them. So, I mean, I think that really would be where I would start. Obviously, we've talked in the past, there are several times about partnering up with a technical co-founder, how to encourage them to get on board, how to basically prove to them, or at least as much as you can, prove to them that the idea has merit and that you've basically removed as much doubt as possible. But those things are all down the line to me, because until you've taken this first step and validated the idea, you don't need code to validate a lot of the ideas. Even something like Hittail, if you think about what Hittail does, it really just analyzes traffic and it takes the best keywords. And so, you know, the best keywords someone should target. So the hack way around that is to find people who use Google Analytics or use an analytics package and say, okay, I'm going to help you with this. It's going to be 10 bucks a month. I'm going to need you to export an Excel export of all your organic keywords from last month, and they send it over and you manually go through it and do the checks, or you hire a VA to do the checks, you know, figure out what your algorithm is going to be, how you're going to recommend stuff, and then send them back the list manually. It's totally hokey. It totally doesn't scale, but it's a way to see if you can provide value that people will pay for without writing a line of code. And, you know, and then from there, if you've figured out that you can provide value and that people are liking it, now you actually have a few customers using your service, which is essentially just a manual service at this point. But from there, you can go approach a developer and say, hey, people are actually using this. People are paying me money for this. How can we automate this? What's our first step to automating this? Because at that point, you don't need to go off and spend 1,000 developer hours to build something. You could start really simply by just building a very basic database that you could manually import to, and you kind of just take the next step, the next minimum viable step, instead of trying to build this full-fledged app from scratch. I hope that helps. Laradrius, I think that's his name. Laradrius Thomas, thanks for the question.
Our next question is from Steven, and he says, what's the best way to approach other bloggers about interest in my blog, and is it even necessary? Here's the thing. I can't stand reading other blogs in the genre I like to write about, because I feel like it sucks up all my time and has information I already know. So how, without liking these blogs, do I get interest in my writing? Does this even matter in a marketing and traffic growth sense? Well, sounds to me like this isn't a question so much about a product as it is about a blog and getting attraction from other bloggers in the niche for this blog. And I would wonder about whether or not these other bloggers feel the same way about it as you do. I mean, is all the information that you are putting out there and that they're putting out there stuff that is common enough between all the different blogs that you could read one blog and pretty much know all there is to know about that particular niche? And, you know, this question doesn't necessarily say what the niche is, but I think it's hard to imagine that there's a particular niche out there that, you know, one, you could just go to one blog and it's a kind of a one-stop shop for everything you could possibly know about that. And even if it is, it's sometimes very nice to get a different take on it, especially for people who aren't fully entrenched into that particular niche. I mean, it sounds like if you're writing a blog about it, you obviously know a lot about it and have read up on it, and you're willing to share that information, but you don't necessarily want to hear other people talk about it because of the fact that you already know all the stuff that, you know, they're going to be talking about. So those are kind of my thoughts on it, but I don't think that it's unwarranted to go talk to these people. I mean, I think that the thing to do is just drop them an email, and, you know, whether you just have an online chat with them or talk to them, you know, one of the things you don't necessarily say in here is, what is it that you're actually looking for from these blogs? Are you looking for recognition from them? Are you looking for backlinks? Are you looking for partnerships? Those are the things that kind of enter my mind. And if you're looking for backlinks, I don't know if getting on these other blogs is necessarily going to mean a whole lot. It might help you in terms of SEO, but in terms of getting their readers to come to your blog and also read your blog when the content is going to be similar, I don't know if that's going to help you a lot. For partnerships, if they have products and you have products and you want to do some sort of a cross-selling, then that's a great way to go. I don't know if you really need to be a reader of their blog in order to approach them, because you can certainly just talk to them about it. I mean, if you can work out some sort of a deal where you are cross-promoting their products or bundling them together, for example, then both of you collectively become an authority in the space just by virtue of partnering and reselling your products together. So those are kind of the things that enter my head with this particular question, but I don't think that it necessarily matters whether or not you get them interested in your writing, unless, of course, your goal is to get them to link to you for, you know, whatever reason.
Yeah, I agree. It would help to know more specifically, you know, what he's looking to get out of this. The other thought I had is that if you already know what's on these blogs, then you can probably just read the title of the post and skim through their posts and get an idea of what they're blogging about. And if you do already know all the information because it's so basic, then that's probably all you're going to need to do to stay familiar with what they're doing and keep up to date. And if you are at an equal plane with them in terms of readership and notoriety, then it should be pretty easy to reach across the aisle and just drop them an email. If you are at a lower kind of playing field than them, if they're just have a lot more popularity and a lot more experience, then sending them an email, you know, it may or may not work. But the surefire way to start getting noticed is to pick the two or three top blogs, you know, that you're looking at in this niche and start leaving some comments. You don't have to read the whole post if you already know the information. Again, if they're commenting on, you know, talking about stuff that you already know, then you should be able to add to that pretty intelligently, pretty fast from the top of your head and be able to improve upon their post. And once you do that a few times, these folks will start to recognize you. And then when you drop them an email, you can mention, hey, I've been a reader, you know, I've been commenting on your blog, and they will likely notice it. But I think it does come back to what Mike said of what exactly do you hope to get out of these relationships. If you just kind of want to network and, yeah, have them cross-promote products, then that's fine. I do also thinking that maybe writing a post about them or even linking to them in a post or two of yours, it'll show up in their analytics and they will notice you. You know, they'll notice that you link to them and they'll probably have Google alerts if you mention them by name, and they'll come out and check out your blog. And that's another way to kind of extend, you know, a handshake and maybe get them to notice you off the bat. So those are our thoughts. Hope those help, Stephen.
So our last question for the day is from Andrew. And he says, hi, Rob and Mike. Great job with the podcast. I'm really enjoying them. I was listening to the How to Drive Traffic to Your Site podcast and noticed that it was recorded a few years ago. I'm curious if all the tactics still apply. For example, do you still view Twitter as not being useful for driving qualified traffic? Thanks in advance for your response, Andrew.
So I think most of the approaches, I think all of the tactics actually that we listed there still apply. I think for his specific question, which is probably all we have time to answer on this podcast, is do you still view Twitter as not being useful for driving qualified traffic? And the answer I have is yes. So I view Twitter as a great networking tool. It's a great way to keep up relationships. It's kind of like an ongoing chat between a bunch of people. It's great for partnerships. It's great for kind of deepening relationships. And it's also really good if you are creating content. So if you're putting out a blog post now and again, whether it's on your company website or your an industry blog, something that is interesting to people who are reading your Twitter feed, then Twitter is a great distribution mechanism. But that's all I view it as. It can certainly draw people in from your Twitter feed to your app, but honestly, you need, I mean, literally tens of thousands of qualified followers to get any kind of sales funnel out of that. And I don't see it as being very viable, nor a very good way to spend your time. I mean, there are much, much more effective ways of driving qualified traffic that we did talk about in this episode. It was episode 6, I'm pretty sure,
yep.
How to drive traffic to your website. And, you know, there's paid acquisition, and then there's SEO, and there's other social media approaches. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this that are going to just be a much better use of your time if you're actually trying to sell something as the end goal.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I mean, I still don't necessarily view Twitter as a great way to drive traffic. Now, I do feel like Twitter has value in that if you already have a product that's established and you're getting people to follow your product on Twitter, then I think that Twitter is a great way to get additional information out about your product or to get people talking about it. But that's going to be generally for people who are already customers of yours. Or if you're running a product where people kind of admire your product or in your space, they admire what you're doing, they may follow you just to kind of hear what sort of things are being said. But I don't necessarily think that those are going to turn into qualified leads. All of that said, Twitter does have an advertising platform, so you may be able to tap into that and use it to get paid traffic. It's not something I've tried yet. I actually have like $100 or $150 that I got through American Express for some program that they were running. I will be trying that out with AutoShark to see how that goes, and I'd be happy to share what I learned from that. But aside from that, I don't think that just having a Twitter account is going to drive qualified traffic that is qualified enough to turn those people into sales.
All right, Andrew, thanks for the question. By the way, he is at videorascal.com. If you have a question or comment, call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of this episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.